Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The following program is presented under the sponsorship of the Democratic National Committee. Chicago, Illinois, the nation's second largest city, tonight opened her doors and bid the President of the United States welcome in one of the greatest demonstrations in the city's history. The 30,000 people lucky enough to force their way into the Chicago Stadium have for many minutes been cheering and applauding the President, and he's been standing here on the platform smiling and waving his acknowledgement of their welcome. Surrounding the stadium on the outside is a crowd estimated at more than 100,000. Unable to get in, they'll listen to his address through loudspeakers. His Honor, Mayor Edward J. Kelly of Chicago, will introduce the President. We present Mayor Kelly.
Now that the cheering for the President has subsided, I will conclude by saying that this vast assemblage inside the stadium and the 150,000 people who marched on foot to this meeting and are now unable to get inside constitute the best evidence of how the people of Chicago have taken our great President to their hearts. As mayor, I want to publicly thank the President for his magnificent accomplishments in the way of public improvement and savings to the local taxpayers in the metropolitan district. The man we honor tonight has given America back to the people for whose benefit this great nation was founded, thus creating a feeling of renewed patriotism, our surest guarantee against conditions like we find in Spain and other countries. For this alone, the country should thank God for Roosevelt. This is a day of days for Chicago, and I'm respectfully asking, at the request of those in charge of the meeting, that the President be not interrupted with applause during his speech due to the shortness of time in which he has to deliver it, when we can be host to the greatest President that America ever has known. Chicago is indeed fortunate. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Chairman, Governor Horner, Mayor Kelly, my friends of the great state of Illinois. I seem to have been here before. Four years ago, I dropped into this city from the airwaves, an old friend come in a new way to accept in this hall the nomination for the presidency of the United States. I came to a Chicago fighting with its back to the wall, factories closed, markets silent, banks shaky, ships and trains empty. Today, those factories sing the song of industry, markets hum with bustling movement, banks are secure, ships and trains are running full. Once again, it is a Chicago that smiles, and with Chicago, a whole nation that had not been cheerful for years is full of cheer once more. On this trip, I have talked to farmers, I have talked to miners, I have talked to industrial workers, and in all that I have seen and heard, one fact has been clear as crystal, that they are part and parcel of a rounded whole, and that none of them can succeed in their chosen occupations if those in the other occupations fall or fail in their prosperity. I have driven that point home. And tonight, in this great center of business of the nation, I give the same message to the businessmen of America, to those who make and sell the processed goods that the nation uses, and to the men and women who work for them. To them I say, do you have a deposit in a bank? It's safer today than it ever has been in our history. It's guaranteed. Last October 1st marked the end of the first full year in 55 years without a single failure of a national bank in the United States. Isn't that on the credit side of the government's account with you? Are you an investor? Your stocks and bonds are up to a 5 or 6 year high level. Are you a merchant? Your markets have the precious lifeblood of purchasing power. Your customers on the farm have better incomes and smaller debts. Your customers in the cities have more jobs, surer jobs, and better jobs. Didn't your government have something to do with this? Are you in industry? Industrial earnings, industrial profits are the highest in 4, 6, or even 7 years. Bankruptcies are at a new low. Your government takes some credit for that. Are you in railroad? Freight loadings are steadily going up, and so are passenger receipts. Because, for one reason, your government made the railroads cut rates and make money. Are you a middleman in the great stream of farm products? The meat and the grain that move through your yards and elevators have a steadier supply, a steadier demand, and steadier prices than you've known for years. And your government is trying to keep it that way. Now, my friends, some people say that all this recovery has just happened. But in a complicated modern world, recoveries from depressions do not just happen. The years from 1929 to 1933, when we waited for recovery just to happen, proves the point. But in 1933, after March 4th, we did not wait, we acted. And behind the growing recovery of today is a story of deliberate government acceptance of responsibility. Responsibility to save business, to save the American system of private enterprise and economic democracy, a record unequaled by any modern government in history. And what had the previous administration in Washington done for 4 years? Exactly nothing. And why? For a very fundamental reason. That administration was not industrially minded, nor agriculturally minded, nor business minded. It was high finance minded. manned and controlled by a handful of men, who in turn controlled, and by one financial device or another, took their toll from the greater part of all other business and industry. But let me make one simple statement. When I refer to high finance, I am not talking about all great bankers, or all great corporation executives, or all multimillionaires, any more than Theodore Roosevelt, in using the term malefactors of great wealth, implied that all men of great wealth were malefactors. I do not even imply that the majority of them are bad citizens. The opposite is true. Just in the same way, the overwhelming majority of businessmen in this country are good citizens. And the proportion of those who are not is probably about the same proportion as in the other occupations and professions of life. So when I am speaking of high finance as a harmful factor in recent years, I am speaking about a minority, which includes the type of individual who speculates with other people's money. And you in Chicago know the kind I refer to. And I refer also to the type of individual who says that popular government cannot be trusted, and therefore that the control of business of all kinds, and indeed of government itself, should be vested in the hands of 100 or 200 all-wise individuals controlling the purse strings of the nation. High finance of this type refused to permit government credit to go directly to the industrialist, to the businessman, to the homeowner, and to the farmer. They wanted it to trickle down from the top through the intricate arrangements which they controlled and by which they were able to levy tribute on every business in the land. They did not want interest rates to be reduced by the use of government funds, for that would affect the rate of interest which they themselves wanted to charge. They did not want government supervision over financial exchanges through which they manipulated their monopolies with other people's money. And in the face of their demand that government do nothing that they called unsound, the government in those days, hypnotized by its indebtedness to them, stood by and let the Depression drive industry and business towards bankruptcy. Now, my friends, we have discovered something in the last 3.5 years. That America is an economic unit. New means and methods of transportation and communications have made us economically as well as politically a single nation. Let me cite an example. Because kidnappers and bank robbers could in high-powered cars feed across state lines, it became necessary in order to protect our people to invoke the power of the federal government. And in the same way, speculators and manipulators from across state lines and regardless of state laws have lured the unsuspecting and the unwary to financial destruction. In the same way, across state lines, there have been built up intricate corporate structures, piling bond upon stock and stock upon bond, huge monopolies that were stifling independent business and private enterprise. And there was no power under heaven that could protect the people against that sort of thing except a people's government in Washington. All that this administration has done, all that it proposes to do, and this it does propose to do, is to use every power and authority of the federal government to protect the commerce of America from the selfish forces that ruined it. Always, month in and month out, during these 3.5 years, your government has had but one sign on its desk: seek only the greater good of the greater number of Americans. And in appraising the record, remember two things. First, this administration was called upon to act after a previous administration and all of the combined forces of private enterprise had failed. And secondly, in spite of the demand for speed, the complexity of the problem, and all the vast sums of money involved, we have had no teapot dome. We found when we came to Washington in 1933 that the business and industry of the nation were like a train which had gone off the rails into the ditch. Our first job was to get it out of the ditch and start it up the track again as far as the repair shop. And our next job was to repair it, to repair the broken axles that had got it off the road, the engine that had been worn down by gross misuse. What was it that the average businessman wanted government to do for him, to do immediately? In the spring of 1933. Five things: stop deflation and falling prices. And we did it. Increase the purchasing power of his consumers or industrial workers in the cities. And we did it. Increase the purchasing power of his customers on the farm, and we did it. Decrease the interest rates, the power rates, and the transportation rates, and we did it. Protect him from losses due to crime, bank robbers, kidnappers, and blackmailers, and we've done it. And how did we do it? By a sound monetary policy that raised prices, by reorganizing the banks of the nation and insuring their deposits, by bringing the businessmen of the nation together and encouraging them to pay higher wages, to shorten working hours, and to discourage that minority. And to discourage that minority among their own members who are engaging in unfair competition and unethical business practices. Through the AAA, through our cattle buying program, through our program of drought relief and flood relief, through the Farm Credit Administration, we raised the income of the customers of business who lived on the farm. By our program to provide work for the unemployed, by our CCC camps and other measures, greater purchasing power was given to those who lived in the cities. money began to go round again. The dollars paid out by government were spent in the stores and shops of the nation, and spent again to the wholesaler, and spent again to the factory, and spent again to the wage earner, and then spent again in another store and shop. The wheels of business began to turn again. The train was back on the rails. And mind you, that train did not get out of the ditch itself. It was pulled out by the government. And we hauled it along the road. PWA, WPA, both provided normal and useful employment for hundreds of thousands of workers. Hundreds of millions of dollars got into circulation when we liquidated the assets of closed banks through the RFC. Millions more when we loaned money for home building and home financing through the federal housing program. Hundreds of millions more in loans and grants to enable municipalities to build needed improvements. Hundreds of millions more through the CCC camp. I'm not going to talk to you tonight about how much our program to provide work for the unemployed has meant to the nation as a whole. That cannot be measured in dollars and cents. It can be measured only in terms of the preservation of the families of America. But so far as business goes, it can be measured in terms of sales made and goods moving. The train of American business is moving ahead. You people know what I mean when I say it was clear that if the train is to run smoothly again, the cars will have to be loaded more evenly. We have made a definite start in getting the train loaded more evenly in order that axles may not break again. For example, we have provided a sounder and cheaper money market and a sound banking and securities system. You businessmen know how much legitimate business you lost in the old days because your customers were robbed by fake securities or impoverished or shaky banks. By our monetary policy, we've kept prices up and lightened the burden of debt. It's easier to get credit, and it's easier to repay what you have borrowed. We have encouraged cheaper power for the small factory owner to lower his cost of production. We have given the businessman cheaper transportation rates. But above all, we have fought to break the deadly grip which monopoly in the past has been able to fasten on the business of the nation. Because we cherish our system of private property and free enterprise, and because we were determined to preserve it as the foundation of our traditional American system, we recall the warning of Thomas Jefferson that widespread poverty and concentrated wealth cannot long endure side by side in a democracy. So our job was to preserve the American ideal of economic as well as political democracy against the abuse of concentration of economic power that had been insidiously growing up among us in the last 50 years, particularly during the 12 years of preceding administration. Free economic enterprise was being weeded out at an alarming rate. During those years of false prosperity, you and I know that one business after another, one small corporation after another, their resources depleted, had failed, or had fallen into the lap of a bigger competitor. A dangerous thing was happening. More than half of the corporate wealth of the country had come under the control of less than 200 big corporations. That is not all. These huge corporations, in some cases, did not even try to compete with each other. They themselves were tied together by interlocking directors, interlocking bankers, and interlocking lawyers. This concentration of wealth and power has been built upon other people's money, other people's business, other people's labor. Under the concentration, independent business was allowed to exist only by sufferance. It has been a menace to the social system as well as to the economic system that we call American democracy. As a matter of practical fact, there is no excuse for it. In the cold terms of industrial efficiency, there is no excuse for it from the point of view of the average investor. There is no excuse for it from the point of view of the independent businessman. I believe, and I've always believed, and I always will believe, in private enterprise as the backbone of economic well-being in the United States. But I know, and you know, and every independent businessman who has had to struggle against the competition of monopolies knows that this concentration of economic power in all embracing corporations does not represent private enterprise as we Americans cherish it and propose to foster it. On the contrary, it represents private enterprise, which has become a kind of private government and is a power unto itself, a regimentation of other people's money and other people's lives. Back in Kansas, I spoke about bogeymen and fairy tales, which the real Republican leaders, many of whom are a part of this concentrated power, are using to spread fear among the American people. But you good people have heard about these fairy tales and bogeymen too. You have heard about how antagonistic to business this administration is supposed to be. You've heard all about the dangers which the business of America is supposed to be facing if this administration continues. My friends, the answer to that is the record of what we have done. It was this administration which saved the system of private profit, the system of free enterprise, after it had been dragged to the brink of ruin by these same leaders who now try to scare you. Look at the advance in private business in the last 3.5 years, and read there what we think about private business. Today, for the first time in 7 years, the banker, the storekeeper, the small factory owner, the industrialist can all sit back and enjoy the company of their own ledgers. They're in the black, and that's where we want them to be. That is where our policies aim that they shall be. That is where we intend them to be in the days to come. Some of these people really forget how sick they were. But I know how sick they were. I have their fever chart. I know how all the knees of all our rugged individualists were trembling 4 years ago and how their hearts fluttered. They came to Washington in great numbers. Washington didn't look like a dangerous bureaucracy to them then. No, it looked like an emergency hospital. And all of these distinguished patients wanted two things and wanted it in a hurry. They wanted a quick hypodermic to end the pain. And they wanted a course of treatment to cure the disease. And we gave them both. And now, my friends, most of the patients seem to be doing very nicely. And some of them are even well enough to throw their crutches at the doctor. Individualism. I believe in it in the arts, the sciences, and the professions. And I believe in it in business. I believe in individualism in all these things, up to the point where the individualist starts to operate at the expense of society. And the overwhelming majority of American businessmen do not believe in it beyond that point. We have all suffered in the past from individualism run wild. Society has suffered, and business has suffered as well. And so, believing in the solvency of business, the solvency of farmers, and the solvency of workers, I believe also in the solvency of government. Your government is solvent. The net federal debt is lower in proportion today, lower in proportion to the income of the nation, and in proportion to the wealth of the nation, than it was on March 4th, 1933. Opportunities for private enterprise will continue to expand. The people of America have no quarrel with business. They insist only that the power of concentrated wealth shall not be abused. We have come through a hard struggle to preserve democracy in America. Where other nations in other parts of the world have lost that fight, we have won it. The businessmen of America and all other citizens have joined in the firm resolve to hold the fruits of that victory, to cling to the old ideals, to cling to the old fundamentals upon which America has grown great.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States speaking in the big Chicago stadium in the Windy City before a capacity crowd of 30,000 people, with hundreds of thousands more on the outside listening to the loudspeakers and lining the streets for a glimpse of it. This program was presented under the sponsorship of the Democratic National Committee and reached you direct from the Chicago stadium in Chicago. This is Carlton Smith announcing. This program has reached you through the National Broadcasting Company.
The National Broadcasting Company wishes to thank Lucky Strike for courteously delaying the start of your hit parade over some of these stations in order that you might hear the special program just concluded in its entirety.